Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Family Business Radio. You can find us here every Thursday at 1 o'clock. And through Family Business Radio, we are showcasing family businesses and building a community that's designed to educate, inform, and support family-owned businesses. So each week, our guests include family business owners, key executive non-family members who are helping to drive those businesses, and the trusted professional advisors that assist them. I am one of your hosts, Pat Romboletti with Sage Executive Search.
And I am Meredith Moore with Moore & Associates Wealth Management.
Hey, Meredith.
It's good to see you, Pat.
Yeah, it's good to see you.
Yep. Let me tell you a little bit about today's show. I'm always excited, but I'm really excited about today because we have a couple of pretty big names here in Atlanta. You know, we know estate planning for the family business owner really encompasses a lot more than just developing tax strategies, and we've talked about that in past shows. But what's at stake really is the survival of the business itself. It's often the sole source of the family's wealth. And today we're really going to look at not just the technical aspects of estate planning, but even more importantly, you know, the underlying emotional issues that really often reside just below the surface. And what's key is to really have an understanding and focus not just on the technical issues of the estate planning, but really know what's going on and have a good understanding of the emotional issues that are at play within the family.
Excellent. Well, our guests today are James Robinson from Schiff Hardin. Welcome, James.
Thank you.
Yeah, and Stephanie Bundapante. I'm learning to pronounce that as best I can, from the Family Business Consulting Group. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, pleasure to have you here. James, you are with Schiff Hardin. Tell us a little bit about your firm and your practice.
Sure. We are a national law firm. Headquartered in Chicago, we've got we've got offices across the country, including right here in Atlanta. As I say, we're full service. So, in addition to what I do, which I'm a partner in what we call the Private Clients Trusts and Estates Group, which focuses on personal planning for families, and particularly for families, business owning families, family businesses. We provide the complete range of legal services to our clients.
Excellent. And I know that you are a prolific writer. I also know that you were doing that in college. I saw that from your background. And by the way, for those who like to know about local schools, where is it that you went to law school?
I went to Emory.
Yeah, I thought so. And your list of articles, we're going to be giving your website later on in this presentation, and I hope people will go there because I saw that you have many, many articles that you've written and all topics that will be very relevant for our audience. So
I hope so.
Yeah, thank you. And Stephanie, your organization, the Family Business Consulting Group, tell us about it. It's something that maybe a lot of our listeners don't know, but it certainly is something that should be in their resource list.
Right. Well, the Family Business Consulting Group is a specialized advisory firm. We work exclusively with business-owning families, helping them navigate sort of the intersection of family and business. I often point out families are complicated, businesses are complicated, and when you put those two things together in the same bucket, it can be a bit challenging. We do a lot of work with families when they're in a transition stage, helping them set up the structures either in their family system or the business system to help those things operate well and keep the business functioning financially healthy and the family emotionally working nicely together as well.
Excellent. And in visiting your site, which we will also provide that information, it seems like you have a wealth of resources. Can you tell our audience some of the things that you provide there?
Yeah, the Family Business Consulting Group prides itself on being thought leaders, so we have a number of books. We also do webinars that are not too dissimilar from this radio format where we'll discuss a given topic. Typically, we do about 9 or 10 of them a year, and so that's another way to learn more on specific topics. We write a newsletter called the Family Business Advisor that comes out every month, so we really work on developing knowledge and on all the different issues that affect families that own businesses together.
And your practice is global?
It is. We have 22 professionals that are primarily located in North America, though I have a colleague who's in the Netherlands, I have one in England, and I have another one in Toronto, but we do travel also for work. So I have colleagues who may be based in Chicago, but they're frequently traveling to Hong Kong or to India to work with very large business-owning families.
Yes. Yeah, well, that's important because I think the world is flat.
That's true.
And for our family business owners locally to know that there's advisors out there who get to see that perspective, it's very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Stephanie, let's really want to start out delving into a characteristic that I know we've talked about in some of our conversations, And conflict avoidance seems to be very prevalent among family business owners. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, as I think I mentioned in our conversation before, I don't think I've ever seen a family business client where conflict avoidance was not a predominant issue, that people really were afraid. And it's not surprising if you think about it, if you realize that your most important personal relationships, your financial security, as you pointed out, Pat, these are often the most important source of wealth and financial security for family. And in addition to that, your professional identity, your sense of role and satisfaction in who you are professionally, they're all wrapped up together. And so it's not surprising to realize that people would be concerned about shaking that up, right? And so if they fear a certain topic could create tension or conflict, they don't want to go there. And so it is really a very prominent challenge that we have to help people realize that their fear of the conflict is often worse than the actual disagreement or the discussion that will be had. And so it's a very important to help families have those discussions.
And facilitate. And Jim, have you seen that tendency to avoid conflict impact the work that you're doing with your clients?
Oh, absolutely. I would say it really manifests itself in two different ways, although they're related, I think. The first is a reluctance to engage in this process at all. In other words, to put off any decisions about planning, whether it's what we might call estate planning. In other words, what happens when someone passes away, someone dies, and then planning for the succession of the business ownership. I think conflict avoidance plays a huge part in that reluctance to even start the conversation. The other related way that this shows up is a reluctance, if and when that conversation does start, is a reluctance to involve, say, the adult children in that discussion, which, to my mind, tends to be a mistake. And let me just say, by the way, that one of the things that I really enjoy about what I do is that every business is different, every family is different. A solution that works great for one family is not going to work very well for another. That said, in my experience and in my way of thinking, it is much better, for the most part, to bring the adult children, those who are going to be affected most by the planning in the long term, into the discussion, not necessarily to get their consent or their buy-in to what you're doing, as much as it is so that they understand and so that they're not surprised when this becomes a reality. I think some of the hardest situations, the hardest personal situations I've had to deal with as a counselor, as a lawyer, is when these things are simply sprung on kids who really have no idea what's coming. And even though it makes perfect sense from a planning perspective, it makes perfect sense from a tax perspective, it's not very well received, and it creates probably even more tension than was present before.
Mm-hmm. James, you know, I know in my practice I've seen this. Have you seen instances where you created documents for people and they passed away and they were sitting on the desk basically because of these avoidance issues?
You mean not having been signed?
Right, exactly.
Boy, we really try to avoid that. We always encourage our clients to get these things done, because frankly, and that's a great point you make, I can draft the best documents in the world that do exactly what my clients want them to do. If they're not signed, if the pieces aren't put in motion, then we really haven't accomplished anything. I will say that by and large, we do successfully avoid that situation, because that's a very difficult thing to fix once someone has in fact passed away.
Mm. Yeah. It seems, you know, we've really hit the heart of this topic, and let's talk about, what should our listeners know about the potential pitfalls of not delving into these emotional issues? I mean, what could happen, basically, if they don't address that as part of this comprehensive estate planning process? Stephanie, can you speak to that first?
Sure. I think that if you... You know, Jim makes a really great point that you want to involve. We often talk about stakeholders, right? There's a lot of stakeholders in the system in a family business. They're the adult family members, the children. There might be the key non-family employees who are involved in the business. We really advocate a maximum of transparency. And it's difficult when it comes to these issues like succession planning, because let's face it, that is a that comes about as a function of the reality of mortality. And that's a real taboo subject, really, in our culture and, frankly, in most cultures. And so people are very uncomfortable with that whole subject matter, and everybody's uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. The senior generation is uncomfortable. The junior generation is uncomfortable. But to address your question, what happens if we don't get past our discomfort is there's an expression in French that says, après moi le déluge. And I have heard some senior generation folks say, you know what, once I'm gone, whatever happens will happen. I won't be here, it won't be my problem. But that's a bit of a selfish approach to take, because what will happen will, you know, everything can be at risk. The family relationships can be at risk. If people feel like their trust was violated, like something was done to them because they had some assumptions about how things were going to go and that isn't how it turned out, the business could be put at risk. You know, if family members end up in court or really fighting in a way that is very aversive, you know, you really can put the whole shooting match at risk. So there's really a lot at stake.
Jim, from your side of the desk, one is.
Well, all I would add to what Stephanie said, which I think is right on, is that oftentimes, especially when it comes to things like litigation over an estate that hasn't been properly structured, or litigation over the ownership or the control of a family business, where thought hasn't been put into how that's going to transition from one generation to the next. I think the biggest cost in most families is the emotional cost, the cost to the relationship. Mm. It's very difficult. There really are no winners in those kinds of battles. In addition, it can be tremendously financially costly as well, but really the emotional cost tends to hit people the hardest.
Mm-hmm. And it is interesting. I have a client that I've been working with recently where, you know, they did some planning. And the generation before, one of the brothers, I think, might have had some tension with the father and ended up deciding to get bought out. But currently, they don't have a relationship anymore. That generation, the brother who was bought out and his brother who now runs a much larger business that's been very successful. And my question is, and I wasn't around, you know, did they sufficiently address it? Did they sufficiently really consider why was this choice being made? You know, they kind of accepted maybe the easy answer and mm-hmm. kind of it made the immediate problem go away. So, yes, the business was preserved, but certainly to Jim's point, you know, I think there's a real loss there in the family that relationship is not meaningful anymore.
So, well, what happens is, what we're talking about really is this big elephant that gets left in the room. Mm-hmm. And what I'm hearing you say is sometimes they bite off a little piece of the elephant.
Yes.
But still doesn't solve the problem. But they feel better, like we've gone away from a little bit of the conflict, so phew. And then they want to move on. Is that pretty much what you've seen?
Yeah, I have often seen that where people want to just do a little something to feel like, well, I can take that off my list. Okay, I've done this, done, check. But again, this is very complex work, you know, and I think that it's well done. We often say succession is a process. It should never be an event. If it's an event, it's because nobody did any planning and somebody has now died and we're picking up the pieces. If we've planned succession, it really is a, you know, 5, 10, 15-year time horizon is really optimal, because you want to involve a whole cadre of professionals, right? Because there's a lot at stake. This is why people avoid. But if you put together a good team of competent professionals, you bring in financial advisors, you bring in attorneys, you bring in an accountant, you know, there's a lot of work to be done. But I think also sometimes people feel overwhelmed by that and they think, I don't even know where to begin. I don't want to do any of this. But rather they should be intentional and think, okay, this is a lot, but we're going to take a deep breath and we're going to put together a team of our people that we trust, and we're going to work through this one step at a time, and we're going to give ourselves enough time, right? And mm-hmm. if we wait till the last minute, we don't have the time, and then we mm-hmm. make half.
A recurring theme on this show is always talking about the team of trusted advisors. So you guys have alluded to this. Let me get from each of your perspectives. So we have family business owner X that's out there. You know, they're saying, Stephanie, James, you know what? I really haven't delved into this. I have a will, but that's about the extent. I've got this great business. What does this process look like? Who do they need to call? Who sits at that table? And what role does each person play? I mean, talk me through what this looks like. James?
Well, you know, in some ways it is client-driven. It oftentimes, when I get involved, it's because their financial advisor, who tends to be the person they talk to most often. If they're not talking to their other advisors or don't have other advisors, their financial advisor will get the rest of us involved. And I think we all bring something different to the table. And in some ways, it's sort of the process of, you know, none of us has, the whole picture on anything, and particularly when we're dealing with a problem or I'm not going to call it a problem, a set of circumstances that in which there are so many different aspects, emotional, financial, there are relationships, we may have subsequent marriages, things like that. It's every situation, as I said earlier, is different. That multiplicity of viewpoints can really add a lot of value, and particularly when we're all communicating with each other. What I've found often is best is maybe to start out with everybody, including the family members who are involved in the discussion, everybody around the same table to kind of get our arms around the issue or the problem or the set of problems, the set of challenges that we have. But oftentimes it will begin as a conversation in my office where I'm meeting with clients for the first time. And to Stephanie's point about, wanting to avoid this whole mess because it just is too complicated, what I find helps is for me to say, look, I can recommend to you all kinds of strategies to get done whatever it is you want to get done. But first, we need to figure out what that is. So talk to me about your situation. Talk to me about your family. Talk to me about your business. Talk to me about what it is you would like to see happen. And then we go from there. And I think if you get into the discussion that way, and I think this works the same for all of us professional advisors, if you get into the discussion that way, I think you get a lot farther down the road, and then we can sort of fill in the details on some of the technical aspects and the planning structures and so forth.
Stephanie, when do you come into this process?
Typically, we'll be brought into the process, like I said, at a transition. So I'll use an example from a client. Let's say that they're in Chicago, and I have a family business in Chicago who has one child who's joining him in the business, and he has another child who's not working in the business. And I was brought in because he wanted to make sure this transition of his child coming into work in the business with him for the first time was going to go smoothly. Well, in conversations with him, I realized that he was also kind of working on his estate planning and on a bunch of other stuff. I said, look, can you do me a favor? Can you just take a pause on that? Let's get to clarity on what this looks like of your child coming into the business with you, and let's get some clarity on what you want that to look like, and then we'll have a conversation as a whole, with all the stakeholders in the room and the professionals to get clarity on how should that then have an influence on the estate planning that we're doing. So he had originally sort of started to redraft the shareholder agreement where he had the child who's working in the business in a position to be able to sort of buy out the other one within 3 years or something. But I said, look, I like to look at things a couple generations down the road. That might make sense. And again, to Jim's excellent point, there is no one-size-fits-all formula for any of these things. Every family is different. What would be the right solution for one family would be completely the wrong solution for another. But I said, what if your child who's not working in the business has a child one day and that person does want to work in the business, and then you've essentially disinherited that branch of the family from ownership? And that doesn't mean they wouldn't be able to work, but then they wouldn't also be owners. So let's just think about that as a consequence. That doesn't mean that we should keep everybody equal owners, but it means that we need to bring up these topics of conversations and really think about it. And I'm planning to have a meeting with this family a little bit later this summer where I'm going to be meeting with the family stakeholders in the morning, and then we are bringing in their financial advisor and their tax estate person and their accountant. And all of us will be in the room talking through, okay, because we might have a fun idea, but I'm not an attorney, and we need the advice of the professionals who have the knowledge about whether or not that approach is even practical, right? And what are the tax consequences of that? And so let's really think about this as a team of professionals. But I will be helping the family get to clarity on that first piece that Jim was talking about. What is it that we want it to say, right? I'm not an attorney. I'm not going to write a shareholders agreement, but I will help the family get to understanding about what should that document say, what feels right to them, what feels fair, and getting all the stakeholders involved in that discussion so that those who have to live with the consequences of those decisions have been part of the decision-making process, and then it will feel way more fair to them than if it was just imposed on them.
Right. And to, just to follow on to that, and I'd like to make the point that if Stephanie and I are in consultation, for example, and she describes to me this issue, I might suggest, for example, that instead of giving the shares or giving the company to one child or another or splitting the ownership, why don't we consider some alternatives, like let's put it into a trust that can benefit the whole family. That kind of back and forth and bringing different ideas to the table is what I'm thinking of when I talk about having all of us in communication, all of us around the same table. It may or may not be the right idea, but until it's sort of talked through, we really don't know.
You know, I'm going to ask this question to all three of you because, Meredith, I know this is right straight in your wheelhouse also, but, you know, how many times one of the things I see here is by getting all of the trusted advisors, you probably have had clients that have shared something with you, and then when you talk to their another member on their team, you find out, oh, no, wait a minute, did they tell you about the stepchild that also isn't in the business? So has that happened? So is that another great aspect of having this whole team?
Yeah, I would say that, you know, when we work with clients, I typically like to do a fairly in-depth intake, and I'll do that confidentially one-on-one with mm-hmm. each of the different stakeholders so that people can feel free to sort of tell me whatever they need to tell me. Mm-hmm. And that gives me as complete an understanding as possible, and that way we can raise the issues of are there other children or other, you know, marriages, because families today are much more complex, right. And so one needs to be thinking clearly about all the stakeholders.
It could be a challenge sometimes because, especially as an attorney, mm-hmm. I am obligated to keep my clients' confidences.
Right.
And so really my first step would have to be talking to the client to see, is it okay to share this information or is this something that you don't want shared with the
right.
rest of the group?
Right.
And that comes up fairly regularly.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily have to be anything as dramatic as a child that
right.
nobody knows about. Although that does happen. It
mm-hmm.
does happen. But oftentimes people are a bit jealous of their secrets.
Right. And Meredith, I'm assuming some people have shared things with you that they haven't thought even necessarily to share. I mean, I guess that's part of it.
Absolutely. And I have the same problem that James does. I can't mm-hmm. divulge information, and sometimes it's very upsetting. I mean, I have a case right now where there's a potential divorce, and the wife keeps calling me, and I can't discuss stuff because technically the husband retained me, and we're dealing with privilege and this, that, and the other, and, you know, drama. But that's the nature of family business, too. So the other thing I was going to bring up, and you guys kind of hit on it, and I know I deal with this all the time, is, you know, everybody gets so caught up with equity in terms of equalization. And when we own a family business and we have kids that aren't working in it, you know, we're always struggling, and at least as an advisor, we're struggling with how do we equalize this estate? And I can think of a client right now. She just wants everything a third, a third, a third with her kids and her new husband. And sometimes that's not always practical. And if you guys could kind of speak to that, especially, you know, as we know, as it pertains to businesses and real estate.
Right. Well, I often say to clients that, you know, fair and equal are not the same construct, and that it's important to remember that families typically really want to be fair with one another, but people have different interpretations of what is fair, and that is a meaningful challenge. And again, you want to help family members. I try and approach people with the assumption that they mean well, right? That their intentions are good. They are good and loving people, and I try and help the family members sort of interact with one another with that same set of assumptions. And unfortunately, sometimes there's a lot of water under the bridge, or there are people who have an axe to grind or whatever it is, and they have a hard time with that. And so they have a filter. And so they will interpret behavior or choices with a very specific filter. And then when you're talking about a case, Meredith, where you have combined families or new families and a new spouse when you have other children, I mean, I see that frequently, and that can often create tension because the alliances between different parts of the family are not the same. There may be mistrust in a new spouse from the children, even adult children, you know, may really have some degree of resentment to a new spouse, and the notion of them sharing a joint asset together can be problematic. I've seen cases where the spouse, because a lot of families will do a second to die policy, which makes a lot of sense from a tax planning standpoint. But the wife is a new wife. Maybe she has a child from a different marriage. So then the kids who are the beneficial heirs also of the estate worry that the new wife is going to give away her share to her child, who's not the child of the patriarch of the family, who, you know, it becomes very complicated very fast. And in those kinds of dynamics, when there's poor trust between family members, it can become very sticky to try and get people on the same page. One of the great things about family enterprise is that people typically do have a good degree of trust with one another. You know, you trust your sibling and you trust that they really have your back, etc. But when there isn't that trust in the family, for whatever reason, it becomes actually harder than a non-family business.
What does your intake look like, Stephanie? I mean, you've got all these potential players that could come into play. So, I mean, do you have everybody sit down and pretty much have a jam session and get everything out on the table and their screaming goes on and you work through stuff? I mean, talk to me again what that part looks like.
No, I would really tend to avoid that. Again, my background...
Sounds like fun.
Yeah. Body armor would be necessary. No. My background is in psychology, and so I also have notions of confidentiality that are very, very prominent in my mind. Now, my client is the family. So I don't have, and I make that very clear. So if it's the father or a senior generation who's bringing me in, I frequently say to them, I am not here to fix your children. My role is to work with the family as a system. But if I speak to them individually, I absolutely keep each individual's confidences. If I feel that they have something that they need to share with the group, I will encourage them to do that, but it's not my place to out them.
So you talk to everybody individually, and then you have a family meeting,
mm-hmm.
and then you'll know what's the real dynamic with each person. So
I
you're
typically,
kind of mediator.
Yeah, I typically write a fairly lengthy report and kind of reflect back what I've heard. And so if there are issues that may have surfaced and I can bring them up without making it clear who said what, I will typically do that way, and then we will discuss it, yeah, typically in a group meeting. And again, depending on the client and what the situations are, you know, sometimes you have a debrief meeting with just the family, the stakeholders. Other times you're going to be debriefing in addition some key non-family executives who are really very central to the business. So it really, again, it depends on each case how that report gets brought back to people and how, again, my role is a little bit to hold up a mirror and to be that trusted advisor. I mean, that notion of trust is central to my being effective. Everybody in the family has to feel that they can trust me, that I am there to protect all of their interests. And if I lose that trust by advocating for one position or another, I lose all utility. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not helpful.
So do you take that report at that point and then say, look, now it's time to bring in the attorney to draft or reflect this in some sort of legal document?
Right. If that's one of the recommendations right. that comes out that, for example, we need to work on the estate planning, right? So if we need to work on the estate planning to make some of this more transparent and more clear, sometimes it's real clear in the patriarch's head what he or she wants to do, but they haven't ever verbalized it because one of the issues might be, I got to choose between my kids in terms of who's going to lead this business. And there may be a really obvious choice, right? But that is very different than actually saying it out loud and having everybody be comfortable with that outcome. So, you know, if that's one of the recommendations, is that we need to work on the estate planning, both from an estate piece and also from a business planning, what does that look like going forward? Then that will be one of the recommendations. And again, I'm not going to do that without a life preserver where I'm not qualified to do the estate planning. And so we will then have a suggestion that we would have a meeting with their professionals. And typically, I mean, not always, actually. Some people don't even have a will. Some people really have nothing at all. And when you're dealing with substantial businesses, which we often are, I often have to tell very young people that they also must have a will. Their children need to have wills. And the estate planning has to be done with the whole family. Right, so siblings have to sort of be in line with what their estate planning is, because what they choose to do is going to affect their brother's life and vice versa.
Mm-hmm. Well, just to follow up on that, Stephanie, one of the first things I learned in my law school trust and estates course is that, in fact, everybody does have a will, even if they don't have an actual document. And, in fact, if they don't have a document, then the state of Georgia or wherever they happen to live has written that will for them. Mm-hmm. So to give an example of a business owner, say, with a surviving spouse and two children, all of that person's assets are going to go equally, a third, a third, a third, to those three people. That's may or may not be what that person wants, but in most circumstances, it's not going to be either workable or satisfactory to anybody.
Hmm. Well, and I think it speaks to that emotional side again. I I don't want to speak for you, James, but I know I've seen a number of cases where it's astounding to me where somebody could hit a high level of financial success and they may have done a will 10, 20, 30 years ago and simply hasn't updated. I think because it's maybe too hard to address those issues and you don't know and you're overwhelmed and all those reasons that you all talked about originally.
I think it goes back to the very first question we started with, which was the reluctance to talk about these things. I think, too, we have to understand that our clients or our prospective clients are very busy doing other things, namely running their own businesses. And so we have to be sensitive to that. At the same time, I do think that we have an obligation to help them as much as we can think through these things and get them done.
Yeah. You know, this topic of conflict, the elephant that we all have left in the room is that in an effort to avoid conflict in the beginning, it tends to generate tremendous conflicts after the fact, when things are perhaps even more emotional because there's been a death and now you're dealing with succession. And we always try to give our audience a little flavor of some real life story so that if they're sitting there thinking it couldn't possibly happen to them, they need to realize that it can. Can you share some insight in terms of things that you've seen where the avoidance of conflict actually just generated a tremendous snowball of conflict?
James, you want to jump in on that one?
Yeah, I would say, and I'll just describe a more or less generic fact pattern that happens pretty regularly, which is, say, mom and dad develop an estate plan that on paper at least makes a certain amount of sense. But what becomes obvious, especially when one of them passes away, is that it really hasn't been thought through very carefully or applied specifically to this family in this situation. And what can happen and what does happen, I'll give you an example. We've been in litigation. I represent a surviving spouse. Her husband passed away about 5 years ago. We've been in litigation with one of her children for at least 4 of those 5 years over what really in the grand scheme of things are not big financial questions, but there is incentive, I think, on both sides to just keep going at this thing, I think largely driven by emotion. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, what was, you know, certainly not pleasant to deal with at the outset is just almost unbearable when the gloves are off and everybody's kind of at war with mm-hmm. one another.
Mm-hmm. Stephanie?
And it really is so... It's so tragic when a family is when you describe a situation where people, it's a parent and a child that are in litigation with one another over money. Nobody wants to end up there. That really is a tragic, tragic outcome. And unfortunately, you do see it quite often, maybe not necessarily to the level of litigation, but I've certainly seen a lot of families where the result is a cutoff, you know, and so there might not have been a financial litigation, but there was a complete emotional cutoff where family members no longer speak to one another, and that's tragic and bewildering. You know, sometimes people think, well, how did we get to this? And again, because often they haven't really ever discussed the underlying issues or were unwilling to do any kind of mental give and take. And, you know, I think in our upbringing, we have an expectation and we raised as children to have to think that our parents are perfect and we put them on a pedestal. And if you imagine a parent who also built a business and, you know, was put on a pedestal, not just by the child, but by, you know, the employees, that person was on a pedestal in a lot of ways, but they're not perfect. Like none of us is perfect. And so when that person kind of comes crashing down, you also have a dynamic where sometimes then the child is so angry that their hero was not perfect that they cannot get over it at all. And so then they respond in a completely irrational manner, truthfully, to challenges or choices that were made that, you know, you shouldn't have such an intense emotional response to. But because that person was, you know, really Superman, it was hard for them to then become everyman. And that's a piece of it.
The other situation, and Meredith, you described it a little while ago, that comes up all the time and is one of the best recipes for conflict is the second marriage or third marriage, whatever the case may be, where the one you described was mom wants to benefit new husband and two children equally. My antennae immediately go up when somebody tells me that, and I'll say, you know, well, let's talk through this and kind of what it might mean if, in fact, this is, you know, this happens. First of all, you know, are your kids really going to want to be in business with your husband? What are the alternatives? Even if at the end of the day we decide a third, a third, a third really is the right result, how can we structure that in such a way that everybody feels like they've gotten what makes sense to them. You know, the husband may not be interested in participating in the business. And in fact, if he is, say, a minority shareholder, he's not going to be very happy because he's probably not going to get any benefit out of that. Yeah. I mean, this is a generic situation, but, I mean, you can see this coming. It happens often enough that it becomes a pattern.
Yeah. Well, and you bring up a really good point about people making assumptions. I can't tell you the number of clients that I've had where, you know, the parent just assumed that the kids would want X, Y, or Z and never asked. Well, wait a minute. You know, again, we tend to infantilize our adult children, and that is not helpful for anybody. Again, part of that is the taboo of this topic. No, you know, nobody really wants to talk about or address their own mortality, and it feels icky to talk about, well, what's going to happen when dad dies? You know, woohoo, it's the vulture kind of a mentality. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants to bring that up as a conversation because rightfully it's uncomfortable. But it needs to be had because sometimes if we don't ever talk about it, we make assumptions. And then people make assumptions, well, that everybody might want to be in the business or that the children who aren't working in the business, of course, have no interest in ownership in the business. And you know, either one of those scenarios could be entirely untrue. Who knows? If you don't ask, you're not going to know.
Mm-hmm. Well, another recurring theme we always have, especially as it pertains to the family business owner, is the illiquidity of the balance sheet. Yeah. And I know I see this all the time when people want to do this happy a third, a third, a third. It isn't just the privately held stock, but again, it's a trend that these guys own a lot of real estate. And when you have second spouse owning real estate with two other sons or daughters, and you're in a bad real estate environment and somebody needs money, you know, you're looking at fire sales, and it's no different as it pertains to privately held stock. And that's what I think the liquidity piece is so key, that family business owners get it because they typically don't have it. They need to understand this concept.
One of the things that we will find ourselves saying when you're doing some of this planning with a family, and so you're doing a debrief at a family meeting, and you say to the table, somebody here needs a raise, and the kids are all excited, like, woohoo, she's going to come and tell them that I'm being underpaid and I should be a vice president and this and the other thing. And no, we actually tell dad, you need to get a major raise because you need to start taking cash out of this business so that you have some financial security outside of this nest egg, which will help you to diversify so that then you might have some choices, both from your estate planning standpoint and also from your ability to let go of the business. Because if all of your financial eggs are still in this basket, you might really have a hard time transitioning from the management role as well, which can create a lot of tension and frustration in the younger generation if they're competent and ready to lead, but you're still there because it's your entire financial security is only in that bucket and you haven't done anything on the side. That's a problem. And so we will often encourage the senior generation, look, you need to be starting to really make some investments, use a financial advisor, and get some of your money out of this business for your own security. And that also will help, because part of this problem is that there is so much risk and there's so much sense of insecurity about what's going to happen that really creates a greater kind of conflict avoidance or fear of what's going to happen. We don't want to talk about it.
And I can see why it needs to be a process, because you may be thinking one way one day and then something happens and you start to think, well, what is that going to impact? I mean, amongst the family, I'm sure that happens. You know, a question and a topic that we've also covered is multi-generations. It's a very hot topic in every workplace, right? And, you know, between what is known as the silent generation and then the boomers, so those are the two sequential, there was a great deal of like-mindedness. The world moved a little slower between those two generations. From boomer on, X and Y, the world is moving incredibly rapidly. And there's where you see this real stretch out. Is that playing itself out also in these meetings where you're trying to talk about the future? And you're right, you have Gen Y who's chomping at the bid, and that's very foreign to silent boomers who kind of earned their way along. Is that causing additional conflict in this process?
I would say yes. And I think the younger generation, you know, again, it depends on their age. It's hard to generalize, but there is sometimes a culture of entitlement, where, I mean, I can't tell you the number of young people who seem to think that, you know, well, I have a college degree and, you know, I can hold a conversation, so therefore I should be vice president of marketing and be earning $150,000. You know, so they're kind of connection to reality is a little bit suspect. And then sometimes the senior generation just thinks, well, who are these people and where did they come from? P.S. you raised them, so you do have some culpability in that. So let's take that back a step. But so definitely I see that creates additional tension. But even before, you know, from a life stage standpoint, when you hit your 40s and your 50s, you should be hitting your stride professionally. Mm-hmm. And if you have a parent who's in their 70s and their 80s who is absolutely still calling all the shots, it's going to piss you off. Mm-hmm. And what happens then is that the competent younger generations, they leave.
Right.
They have options. And what you left with is the deadwood, the ones who really think it's nice to have a cushy job. You can roll in whenever. You have the family name. So that is not a good recipe for success for the business long term, obviously. Yeah. Too.
And Jim, have you seen this in your practice as well?
I have. I recently wrote an article that my co-author and I called The Sea Change in Generational Wealth. And what this really is about and what I'm seeing as a practical matter in what I do is a greater willingness to consider long-term vehicles, both for the preservation of the family legacy from outside threats and for the protection of the family legacy from the kids, the grandkids, from within, I guess is the best way to put it. Mm-hmm. Because there's a mindset that this is something we've worked very hard to accomplish. We've worked very hard to create this thing. What is available to us to protect it to the best we can. That also provides, I think, a very good entree for the kids to start getting involved in the management, without necessarily jumping in with both feet at once.
Mm-hmm. Let me talk about a scenario that we rarely talk about on the show that, frankly, is going to happen more likely on a day-to-day basis. But what if there's a major disability event or medical event for one of the senior people, especially when you're getting people that are older? I mean, that's going to have a huge impact. Obviously, I know it's addressed in the operations agreement, but I guess from a legal and stuffing from a psychological standpoint, have you seen that happen? And what have been the implications? And how have you guys gone about addressing that?
Yeah, sadly, I have seen that happen where you have a leader of a business who is gently becoming impaired, and you have issues like Alzheimer's, for example, that will start to manifest themselves, and where an individual, it's not obvious immediately. If somebody has a stroke or some kind of an event where there's a more rapid change in their comportment and their capacity, that's easier to address. If somebody's starting to slip away, then you have the emotional load of people's denial, right? Mm-hmm. So all the other stakeholders, everybody's terrified about what's going to happen when he goes anyways. So people don't want to acknowledge that there's a problem. If no one has done any planning about what is supposed to happen as a succession process, and then you're faced with this dilemma, again, this need to avoid, you really can't be avoiding anymore, right? I mean, once people start to realize that somebody is declining, everything is at jeopardy. And it would need, then you're in an accelerated process in terms of the estate planning and putting all of your ducks in a row because you really need to make some changes. But unfortunately, if you don't have a plan that's been written down and people can say, we've all had a conversation, we agreed that this was going to be what should happen, and frankly, it's very hard to talk about death and dying, but you should also talk out loud about things like disability. You bring up a really good question, and that's part of the planning. People should have a plan in place for what will happen if.
Well, and there's all those scenarios in an operations agreement, and maybe you can talk about all those scenarios too, James, that should play out in that kind of agreement.
They should, but I just want to make the point that very often those things are not addressed in the documents that I see, either on the personal planning side or on the business planning side. Oftentimes it will contemplate someone dying, very often will not contemplate disability. And if it doesn't, then you do have quite a challenge, because what do you do? Most people want to avoid things like guardianship. It tends to be a very unpleasant process. It's embarrassing. The courts get heavily involved. Oftentimes, though, if there has been no planning done ahead of time, that's what you end up having to do, is actually go to court, have a guardian appointed for, say, an incompetent business owner who still has legal control of the business in order to be able to exercise the necessary, let's say, shareholder level or member level control over that company. What I would suggest, just by way of something to avoid that kind of scenario, number one, is to address it in the agreement. And specifically, be careful about how you define those things like disability. One thing that I've seen people do that I really like is to refer, for example, to, say, if you've got a disability policy, just use that definition so that nobody can argue about whether this person is disabled or not.
Right. And I would also add, just as another process or kind of an architecture that you should have in place that would be helpful is to have an independent board of directors. If you have an independent board of directors in place, I mean, first of all, I think that that serves a great purpose in many, many respects, but that's critical to the succession process. And in particular, that those might be individuals who have a little bit of distance and a little bit of objectivity, and they can call a spade a spade. It's very hard for your son to say to you, Dad, you're in decline, right? I mean, because the emotional load for the child is just very, very hard, and particularly if you have a good relationship. You know, hopefully things are all really good normally. But if you have other independent business people who can notice, you know, geez, you know, John seems not to be himself anymore, it might be easier for those people to bring up those topics. And then, you know, in their role as a board, that's an appropriate role for them to be playing. So again, I would just say that, that's an example of why, another reason of many, why you should have a board of directors.
Right. And on the personal planning side, what I would also suggest is that, and I'm seeing a lot more interest and willingness to do this, is to set up what we call revocable living trusts, mm-hmm. with what we call standby provisions, so that if, say, Dad becomes incapacitated, and we'll define that carefully in the document, someone else can step in without having to go to court, without having to have a guardian appointed, and continue running things.
Mm-hmm. This it really speaks to the benefit of having this long-term process, because if you've already started to put, you know, you brought the elephant into the room 10 or 15 years ago, and you've agreed as a matter of course that transparency is the safe net for the family, even if you started that 15 years ago and some event happens 10 years later, it isn't as awkward, mm-hmm. because you've already established that this is a topic that we've taken a deep breath a long time ago. The further away from the impending event, the probably the least emotional you can be, and it will kind of set things up. And the other observation I have, and maybe you've seen some of this, but we talk about this in terms of breaking up the family, and we've hinted to the impact on the business, but it can drive the business. Either it has to fold because the conflict becomes too great. It becomes unfunctional because the employees are torn by the conflict. Or if you're in a fairly competitive environment and anyone is aware of the conflict, it could be a first mover opportunity for them to step ahead of you. You know, have you seen this whole business kind of go away? I mean, the whole point is to preserve it, but it can be lost without all of this.
Most often what I see is a business failing. You can point to outside forces that may be, quote unquote, the reason for that failure, but when you really look under the surface, it's because no one was really at the wheel to deal with these issues as there was previously.
Mm-hmm. Right, things come out.
Right. Oh, and ambiguity on leadership is really, really problematic. So if there isn't clarity on who is in charge, then that really does create problems in the business for any number of the reasons that you were describing. Mm-hmm. I was just going to point out that, you know, we were talking about this process and this fear that people have around the topic of you know, I guess of mortality, and you brought up the important point of disability.
Morbidity is actually the term.
Yes. But
your insurance word of the day.
I've seen clients where, you know, they've done some planning and then it's the son who dies. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, and so the reality is that you have to do this planning and you really have to think about the unthinkable across the family system. And this is where, you know, again, that estate planning across the family system is an important element, because, you know, I had a family client where the plans were made and it was going to be the son who was going to take over, and then he died, and you know, then everybody was completely, you know, unable, because again, your ability to cope, your cognitive skills decline tremendously when you're coping with massive grief. I mean, that's not surprising, but that's why it's important to do this planning, because you're not thinking at your best when you're in, you know, in grief.
And I know I had a case where one of the owners had a diagnosis of cancer and was out, which created resentment on the other shareholder that he had to still pay a dividend out even though he wasn't working. And ultimately, when the client passed away, the whole operations agreement had to get litigated because the guy ran off with all the buyout money from the spouse. So it was a big mess. I guess my point is that it creates animosity if somebody does get hurt or they're sick for a long period of time, because that person is still compensated if they are a shareholder in fact, in the business. So,
but again, that's where you need to make the distinction for people. What's the distinction between ownership versus management,
right,
et cetera? Because if you're earning a salary for your day job, mm-hmm, as a manager, that's appropriate. And perhaps if there's some insurance to cover for disability to cover that gap. But a dividend is an ownership benefit. It has nothing to do with whether you're there at all.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So
what I'm hearing, a couple things, and I'll ask a question at the end of this, but this, the trusted advisor group, I mean, really having transparency among all of the experts seems to be at the foundation of having this all work really well. And I guess, we talked a little bit before about after someone has deceased, challenges to an estate plan or challenges saying this wasn't really well thought out. Does the fact that somebody has obviously pulled together a whole team of advisors, maybe brought the board in, brought somebody like Meredith in financial and brought you, Stephanie, in emotionally, and you, Jim, does that help to kind of mitigate, especially if it goes to litigation, this argument of this wasn't well thought out or this what really probably wasn't what he wanted? Does that take some of that off the table as well?
I think what I would say is that you'll probably get a much better result.
Right.
And so, yes, the answer, I guess, would be yes, that because you've got a much better result that's much better thought out, it's much harder to argue that mm-hmm. that didn't happen.
Right, right. So, if you were to, Stephanie, draft the document that says, in my dream world, this is how I hope people would prepare for estate planning, and you, Jim, the same, what would that look like? What would you want them to be doing and when, and what are the steps?
I guess, I would really hope that the family had a tradition of open communication and open communication in a trusting environment. Mm-hmm. And so that, the first piece of that is, again, that notion that you don't want to avoid these topics, that avoidance is actually worse. It'll lead to conflict, like we talked about before. But also, you have to listen with an open mind, right? And so I think people sometimes come into these conversations with preconceived notions. They come in with all their baggage, and they're all agitated. And so they hear what sort of fulfills their storyline in their head, and they're not really hearing what's being said, and they're not being open to the why, try and respect that it's a hard conversation to have. So if your parent comes to you and wants to have this conversation already, be appreciative of the fact that they've taken that first step, because I think that's a really hard thing to do. But then I think you want to treat each other like respectful adults and understand. And, I often hear people talk about, I don't want my parents to put themselves at financial jeopardy. And so while it's nice that they have assets that they would like to transfer to me, I want them to make sure that they protect themselves first. I mean, they're the ones who worked hard all their lives and they've earned this money. And I think that people would be surprised at the sophistication of conversation. And it really, in some respects, it's a great opportunity for a family to respectfully talk about, what is the legacy, right? And sometimes I think if we think about it in this context, that is a positive way to look at it. What is the legacy that you would like to leave for future generations, both from a family individual planning standpoint, but from a business, right? So and how can we really protect that legacy? And if it was this, if you're dealing with a founding generation, that's one package. But, sometimes if you're dealing with a family that it's third, fourth generation in, this is a legacy of our forebears, right? Mm-hmm. And so we have a responsibility to be the stewards of this. And I think that can be a really wonderful, and you were talking about before we went on air about philanthropy, right? Mm-hmm. And so that can be a piece of it, right? Mm-hmm. And I think it can be a rewarding conversation. I think families maybe need to not kind of de-escalate a little bit the fear mm-hmm. and use this as a platform for having a real nice adult conversation with one another about legacy.
Well, legacy, steward, and philanthropy are three less emotional words than are typically. So those are great. And Jim?
A few years ago, I worked with a client who had me include in his will what he called a moral will.
Mm-hmm.
And I had never really even heard of the concept before, but basically what it was his own personal statement. And the gist of it was, we love all of our children. We think money is important, but it's really only a means to an end. What's most important to us is our relationship. And I think if you go into this process with that mindset that, we may be talking about planning for wealth and so forth, but really what we're doing is looking to preserve the family relationship, assuming that it's there in the first place. And mm-hmm. if not, then we need to take a step back and say, well, before we even get to this conversation, how do we start to address this? But I think if that's uppermost in your mind, in other words, what we're really looking to do is preserve the family relationship, then I think you're a long way down the road to getting this done well. The other thing I would say again is that in my experience, it's been most helpful when adult children, adult beneficiaries, whoever they may be, really understand the reasons for these things. In other words, mm-hmm. whether they might agree with them or disagree with them, they understand them. Mm-hmm. And I think that helps tremendously.
Mm-hmm. Not created in a vacuum.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This is a time when we like to offer our listeners some tips that they can maybe come back to our site and grab. So you've given a bunch today, and they're all been great. Any last-minute tips that you'd offer up, Stephanie?
Definitely, I would say, you know, fear of conflict is almost always worse than the conflict itself. Mm-hmm. I think that's important. I think you want to surround yourself with a team of professionals. And again, that notion that succession planning, you really want this to be a process and not an event. And so take the time. You know, it's never too early to start this process, I guess, would be the take-home message. And it's also, P.S., not too late. Okay, mm-hmm. So if you're older and you think, gosh, this is, you know, maybe the ship has sailed, it's never sailed. Okay, it's really never too late to be having these conversations. So I think that's an important thing. And again, back to this idea of, you know, you've raised your children, hopefully with the values that were central and important to you. Trust that they can cope with this information. And the younger generation, the adult children, you know, listen with respect and try and hear what's being said to you in a way that doesn't make your parents regret opening this Pandora's box. You know, I think that's important that people behave like adults on this very sensitive topic.
Yeah. And Jim?
Well, when I look at my own three kids, one of the things that constantly amazes me is how different they all are from each other and how different they are from me. Mm-hmm. And so one point I would like to just make, you know, as sort of a final point is, you may think you know how your kids are going to receive this. You may think that this process isn't going to work because your kids will react so and so. My kids always surprise me. Mm-hmm. I never really can predict what they're going to do. And so try to go into this process without any sort of fears or preconceived notions about what's going to happen, because you really don't know. And you don't know really what's going on with your kids.
Oh, that's excellent. Give them the benefit of the doubt.
Mm-hmm. That's great, guys.
Well, thank you. I appreciate both being on the show. We always know that our listeners might want to reach out to you because you've opened up some great topics. Jim, if they want to reach you, how can they get in touch with you? Website and phone number and email?
Sure. Well, our website is www.schiffharden.com. That's SCHIFFHARDIN.com. My email address is jrobinson@schiffharden.com. My phone number is 404-437-7038. I'd love to hear from anybody out there.
Thank you. And Stephanie?
Right. So our web address is www.efamilybusiness.com. And on our website, you can see all of the bios of our professionals, as well as lots of listings of books that we've published and information about our upcoming webinars, et cetera. So that can be a good resource generally. And in terms of my contact information, it's my last name, which is Brun de Ponté. I'll have to spell that. B as in boy, R-U, N as in Nancy, D as in David, E, P as in Peter, O, N as in Nancy, T as in Tom, E, T as in Tom, @efamilybusiness.com.
You never have to spell that, do you?
No. It's as if I have to think about that every time. Yeah. And my phone number is 678-773-1675, and I would be happy to speak to any of our listeners.
Yeah, thank you. And listeners, you know that you can always find this information also on our website at www.familybusinessradio.businessradiox.com. If you go there today, you will see their bios and links to their websites and this contact information as well. And both of you have a tremendous number of resources on your site, so I really encourage people to reach out to that. And then by Tuesday of next week, our listeners will be able to download the podcast from today. So thanks again.